and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Trump claims Iran wants a deal very badly as the U.S. blockade begins in Hormuz. It's not clear what this blockade aims to achieve other than further global economic dislocation. Trump is not only running out of options, he's running out of time. Cross-talking Trump and Iran, I'm joined by my guest, Esteban Curelo Lopez in Toronto. He's a news desk editor for The Cradle. In Calgary, we have Mohanan Ayish. He is a professor of sociology at Mount Royal University in Calgary. And in London, we have Ali Zadeh. He is a political analyst and presenter at Jadel TV. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Esteban, let me go to you first in Toronto. I said in my introduction, Trump is running out of options, and he's running out of time. How do you assess that claim?
Well, I think that has been the case from the very beginning of this war. I think all of the talk that this was meant to last 4 to 6 weeks was only just to cover for the initial failure of what they expected to be an operation similar to the one that that we saw the kidnapping of Maduro in Venezuela. But nevertheless, now with this blockade, it seems like things are even worse for Donald Trump because he has essentially admitted something that we all saw happen almost as soon as the war started. And it was that all of a sudden, economic sanctions against Iran were, well, ineffective. And now what is this supposed blockade trying to do? He's trying to, again, strangulate Iran economically like they have been for the past 47 years and to somehow lift a blockade that didn't exist on February 27th. I mean, Iran's control of the Strait of Hormuz started because of the war, of a war of aggression, an illegal war of aggression that Donald Trump started and now has absolutely no clue how to end, because at the end of the day, this does not serve U.S. interests. This does not serve even Western interests. It only serves the interests of a messianic government in Israel that is dead set on seeing the entire region set aflame.
Professor Ayish in Calgary, and there's more and more evidence here, you know, and I try to keep everything balanced here, but considering the origins of this conflict and the influence of the Israeli lobby and the Israeli government on the Trump administration, and particularly the president, we see more evidence of this during those so-called negotiations in Islamabad, which essentially was theater. Nothing was accomplished. Nothing was going to be accomplished there. And we have very strong evidence that the vice president was reporting to the prime minister of Israel. I mean, no wonder this cannot be resolved, because Israel wants this war to go on, or I should say want America to keep this war going on against Iran. Go ahead in Calgary.
Absolutely. So the Israeli state's goal here is the collapse of the Iranian state. That's what they want. So they don't care if it's chaos, destruction, not just in Iran, but in the entire region. This suits them just fine. They actually also want the Gulf countries to be weaker.
Yep.
So they're okay with all of this being going down a path of destruction and chaos and instability. That is what they thrive on, or at least that's what they think they're going to thrive on. They're going to pay for it in the long run. But at any rate, they absolutely have played a long game in pushing Trump towards this path. Now, I don't want to get Trump off the hook here. He's a grown man. He's the president of the United States. He's making his own decisions, too. So he's clearly following along. He thinks this is going to be good for U.S., for elites. I don't know what he's thinking, but clearly this administration is acting in a clueless way. Let me go back to one quote from Trump back in June of 2012 at the conclusion of that war on Iran. If you recall, reporters asked Trump, and off the cuff, and he used explicit language that I won't repeat here.
I remember.
Remember that? He said, I don't think they know what they're doing. Well, he's part of that now. He has no idea what he's doing. And all of this, this strategy that they came up with in the last minute, it sounds like, to stop the movement of the talks in Islamabad, this brilliant strategy he just came up with, all on his own, I assume, to blockade the blockade, pulling back his team to enact this strategy is absolute nonsense, and it's not going to go anywhere. I mean, we're still waiting to see how it all plays out. And undoubtedly, it will generate more economic pressure on Iran. But Iran has shown that it can withstand all of this. I will judge basically how well that strategy is working for the US by the actions of the Iranians. If the Iranians are actually feeling this, they will then shut down the ports in the Gulf, which will cause more pain for their U.S. and regional economy and the global economy than it will for Iran. But unless I see the Iranians taking on that move, then I'm going to go ahead and assume that this strategy isn't even working on Iran itself.
Yeah, because we think of the energy going out of the strait. What about the materials for the Gulf countries? They need, food, for example. Okay, that's not going to get in. The Arachi, the foreign minister, Iran's foreign minister, he's turning into a bit of a rock star because he's very, very eloquent. He's not one of those crazy Arabs that everyone in the West has been taught to believe. I mean, very demure, very intellectual. And, he's come up with these phrases that are very easy to comprehend, and they make a lot of sense, like security for all or security for none. Prosperity for all or prosperity for none. These things are very easy to understand, and he's right, Ali.
Yeah, Araghchi has been with diplomatic services for a very long time. But you have to understand that despite all the credits that I can give Mr. Araghchi, and I think he's had a fantastic performance in the last 44 days, but the language comes from the success of Iran in the battlefield. Araghchi was deputy to Javad Zarif during those 2 years of negotiation called JCPOA, but we didn't hear those kind of phrases back then. But in a sense, Iran, in that 44 days, existential war showed a kind of military power and a kind of success on the field that, in a sense, was translated in the diplomatic language, and Araghchi became the voice and the kind of ventriloquist for that kind of new power, especially given that Iran as if discovered the Strait of Hormuz and the kind of power that was unleashed through that on the global market and on the global scene. In a sense, these kind of things are being heard from Araghchi. It's not only Araghchi. Ghalibaf doesn't sound the same as Ghalibaf 6 months ago, 4 months ago. If you look at Twitter or X.com, the Iranian embassies across the world, they're all like using the Twitter accounts, and the language is very different from the Iran 2 months ago. So in a sense, it seems that we are dealing with a new Iran, which we somehow owe it to Mr. Netanyahu and Mr. Trump, because Iran was like somehow very humble under 6 years of strategic patience. And yeah, with Trump and Netanyahu taunting Iran too much, somehow Iran got tired and fed up with that. And now we are seeing a different Iran. But let me just go back to what the other guest said, that I think the reason Iran accepted to sit down on the negotiation table and the ceasefire, accepting the ceasefire, was not with the delusion that United States is going to accept Iran's terms and conditions. In a sense, Iranians knew that it would be impossible for Trump to officially surrender and concede a defeat. But they wanted to allow a possibility of decoupling between United States and Israel, because the feeling and understanding was that Trump was pushed into this war by Netanyahu. And really soon after that, he realized big mistake, maybe from day three or day four. Remember what Witkoff said on 20...
Yeah, but Ali, let me go to Esteban here. I mean, once you got on this train, the conductor has already got his instructions. I mean, Trump is on the ride. Let me go to Esteban in Toronto here. He can't get off this train without facing political disaster internationally, globally, geopolitically, and domestically. So I have no crocodile tears for the president. Esteban.
What Ali was saying is completely, completely on point. And to what you're saying, Peter, I mean, Donald Trump is caught in the escalation trap. You know, every analyst agrees on this. Who set this trap? It was the Israelis. It wasn't Iran. Yeah. Iran actually warned about everything we have seen Iran do since the start of the war. They warned they were going to do beforehand. I mean, it was almost like a manual. You know, they just went point by point, retaliating against Gulf countries, blinding U.S. systems in the region, shutting down, or I prefer to say taking control of the Strait of Hormuz, etc. They knew all of this. And yet the arrogance, the hubris, you know, whatever the Mossad and Netanyahu sold to the U.S. president, he bought it wholesale. And I mean, you know, this is actually where you would see a marked difference between previous U.S. presidents.
Esteban, let me ask you a question. It's important here. Do you think that Netanyahu and the Mossad actually believed the story they were telling Trump? I don't. They just wanted Trump to get into a forever war. They knew that what they were selling him was not true. Keep going.
Absolutely not, because previous U.S. presidents have heard the same story. I mean, you had I think his name is John Kerry, just a few days ago, saying this was the same thing that Netanyahu told us when we were in power, when Clinton was in power, when Obama was in power. I mean, these are lies. The Israeli government lies with a purpose. They lie constantly. They made an art form out of lying. I mean, you know, they will lie about the reality that you see with your own two eyes. So, of course, whatever they presented Trump was based on fiction, only to get the U.S. caught into this escalation ladder, of which Donald Trump, I mean, the only way out he has is capitulation. That's it. That's the only way, is accepting Iran's demands, or at the very least, accepting that he has to sit on an equal level with a nation that up until February 27 was considered a middle power. And now all of a sudden, because of this war, now we're talking about a regional superpower. So when he goes out and says, oh, Iran doesn't have the cards, no, Donald, you don't have any cards.
It's exactly right. And I thought it was very, I think it was the New York Times that ran a very lengthy piece about Iran possibly becoming one of the great powers in the world. And I think it has obviously the potential to reach that in this war. Is that's what this war is really all about. And that's what we're going to talk about after the break. After that break, we will continue our discussion on Trump's war and Iran. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing Trump's war on Iran. Okay, let's go back to the good professor in Calgary. I think the way this war is framed in the West and primarily in the United States is that it's not framed in the way that I think reflects reality. Iran has been put in a box for about 47 years, and it has the opportunity to break out of it. And now it wants to reset the entire strategic order of the region. That means the Americans must leave, Israel must be tamed, and there must be security for all. It sounds, you know, to a Western ears, this sounds fanciful, but that's what the reality is right now. And I think that this is a jailbreak. This is, Iran is saying, Iran must return to its natural place in the geopolitical order, because for 47 years, that has been not even conceived of, but that's the reality that's coming into being. Would you agree with that?
So the long-term vision, in terms of the long-term vision, yes. But there are some major still obstacles and hurdles ahead. It won't be that easy. So certainly Iran has established itself as a power to be reckoned with over the last 40 days or so. But there are going to be some serious obstacles. I think the main one is how are they going to, you know, incorporate the Gulf states into this vision?
Yep.
That's going to be key. Now, yep. They've had to, you know, part of their strategy has, of course, been attacking the economic and security infrastructure that is American built in the Gulf states. And it is their way of really, you know, diminishing American power in the region and hurting the global economy. That has been their best strategic asset. But that does come with negative consequences as well, because for the Gulf states themselves, yes, they are in reality part of the American security and economic infrastructure. But for those countries, it is their civilian infrastructure that is important for their national interests.
Yep.
So they're going to need to do a lot of work to repair those relations. And of course, the Gulf states are not a monolith. You know, you have the UAE and Bahrain on one side. You have Qatar and Oman on another side. It's hard to read where Saudi is leaning. But I think watching how this all transpires in terms of Iran-Saudi relations whenever this war ends will be a critical factor in seeing whether or not the Iranian state is able to realize this vision. Ultimately, I believe that the best thing for the region is for the removal of U.S. influence there. That'll be better for Americans as well.
Yep.
Is an absolute restriction on Israeli aggression, a resolution for the Palestinian people, the full realization of the Palestinian people's rights, because that is the root cause of all of this instability. This is the root cause. It's Israel's aggression against the Palestinians. That's what is causing all of this. So that has to be addressed. And so that means that the region will have to come together and work together, the Gulf and the Iranians, and work for people's sovereignty. You know, this is something sovereignty that all collective groups around the world want, is to be sovereign people. They want to be able to build their institutions how they want to build them. They want to be able to use their resources how they want to use them, for their own good, not for the good of some foreign invader. So the people of the region want that. And to realize that goal, they're going to have to work together. But it will be a long-term project. It will not be easy sort of weaken Israel and, convince the Americans that it's in their interest to become, you know, equal partners as opposed to imperial invaders of the region. So all of these are still difficult to accomplish, but that has to be the vision if we really are serious about establishing a peaceful and prosperous.
I think you should become a diplomat. I think you can convince anyone because you're very, very reasonable. Ali, the whole point of it here is there needs to be a new security architecture. Obviously, Iran has to mend fences with its Arab neighbors, but one thing is for sure, which way Saudi Arabia goes. What I would just say, did the Americans protect you when it was necessary? All that money you spent on all your sophisticated weaponry, did it save you? No, it didn't save you, okay? There is a reckoning going on because the American security umbrella isn't what it used to be. Go ahead, Ali.
The word that the professor said was, I think, is a central word, sovereignty. But look at that. The Persian Gulf countries traded the sovereignty for security since 1990. They haven't had any sovereignty. I mean, they offered $2.6 trillion worth of contracts to Donald Trump only 6 months before this war started. And look at how Trump rewarded them. He brought an absolutely unnecessary war of choice to the region, leading to destruction of a lot of this country's infrastructure. Look at that. Israel attacked Doha last summer. So in a sense, the regional order was already broken, not by Iran, but by Israel. And America sat there, watched it, and didn't do anything. So I'm sure Arab countries understand that Iran is not main culprit. And if Iran would go down, if Iran had lost in this war, and Iran would have opened into either kind of the war of separation inside or kind of civil war, Israel would have come for them one after another, as Israel came for Doha last year. So in a sense, I think the reckoning which is needed it should be done more by Persian Gulf countries. And I think they do it because, look at that, in 2019, September, when Ansarullah attacked Aramco, Saudis really quickly came to the senses. Yep. And 3 months after that, they offered peace talks with Qasem Soleimani in Baghdad. Unfortunately, Donald Trump sabotaged by assassinating Soleimani. So in a sense, I'm sure these countries are more interested in doing trade, not into going into war. So I think they do two things. One, really quietly, they tilt into the East, Russia and China, and they try to hedge their bets, and they go away from the United States slowly in a way that doesn't anger Trump or doesn't create a reaction from the United States. But they're not going to pay again to rebuild certain destroyed American bases in the region, because that's going to be crazy. Paying them for what? For inviting more war to the region? And also, Iran is not interested in expansionism. Iran is not Israel. Iran is not interested to annex Bahrain, which was part of Iran until 1973. Iran has offered a cooperative regional order from a long time ago. Yep. It was the Arab countries which rejected that base pushed by American incentives.
They chose badly. That's what history tells us. They chose very badly. Okay.
And they didn't listen to what Ayatollah Khamenei said when he said it's going to be a regional war. They didn't take that warning seriously.
Esteban, I think we all are on the same page here on this program. I think we all know how we got here, all the mistakes and what needs to be done. Meanwhile, gentlemen, There's evidence that the Americans are sending plane after plane of more weaponry to Israel. Troops are moving into the region. They didn't get the crosstalk memo, I guess, but this is far from over. Esteban.
I have no doubt. I have no doubt about that, Peter. I mean, as you said, we have seen the flights. We have seen it before, too, right? Like the backstabbing during the diplomatic talks, using diplomatic talks just to prepare for a restart of the war. I mean, Netanyahu already said it this weekend. We're going to continue fighting Iran. I mean, this man has absolutely no qualms about what is coming. And Donald Trump, and, you know, I don't want to make this sound like this is a problem of Donald Trump. Exactly. I think this is a problem of the United States government as a whole. They simply do not have the vision to sit down with another nation and look at them eye to eye and say, how do we reach a coexistence deal, right? Everything has to be vertical. Nothing can ever be horizontal. These are relationships. This is the imperialist worldview. We will tell you what to do. We will tell you how to do it. And we will tell you who to do it with. Remember, what is happening right now in the Strait of Hormuz, we cannot lose sight of this, is also aimed at China. Yep. When he took Venezuela, essentially, you know, took the country hostage, this was aimed at China. Now Iran, now he's trying to block ships coming in and out of Hormuz. This is also aimed at China, because at the end of the day, that's the one thing that unites war hawks on both sides of the aisle, be them Republican, be them Democrat. It's we have to confront China at some point. So Iran is still just kind of a step in that direction. And you can see the hovers from the U.S. government in how they act. But at the same time, well, Iran is proving to be just that obstacle that they cannot overcome. And at some point, they're going to have to accept that we need to get together. We need to accept at least some of the demands that Iran is presenting, because the escalation ladder is only going to take us to more disaster. And as the other guests are saying, all of their allies in the region are going to get caught up in it. And not just their allies in the region, but also think about what's happening in Southeast Asia with all of the shortages, with everything that's happening. I mean, the U.S. is losing their luster every single day, every single hour. More and more people realize, hey, they are the destabilizing force in the world.
You know, let's go back to Calgary. Professor, is it going to be the world that tells the United States to knock it off? I mean, the economic indicator, every hour that passes, the problems compound themselves. It's not going to be immediately felt in the United States outside of the gas station, but the Asia is very, very different, okay? They're the ones that are going to have to call this off.
And Europe.
And Iran
did release a statement this week saying, you know, Europe needs to do more and play a more constructive role in putting pressure on the Trump administration. Let me go back to never
count on the Europeans doing the right thing. I'm sorry, keep going.
But let me go back to a comment you said earlier, because I want to emphasize this. Far from being a friend to the American people, Netanyahu, and I've said this for years, Netanyahu has nothing but contempt for the American public.
Of course, of course.
And the reason I say that, and the reason I've said that for years, is because he is not a dumb guy. Netanyahu is actually very smart. I know that the things that he has said, speaking to a specifically American audience, are just blatant lies. That any, you know, school children will know that they're lies if you are in the region and know the dynamics of the region. So he must have so much contempt for the American audience that he thinks that they will buy his lies, because he's going to say them so nicely with a big smile and say them over and over again. And the pro-Israel lobby will repeat them. And American politicians who are, you know, very friendly to the Israeli state and Zionists themselves will repeat them and so on. But it's just nothing but contempt. And he's always tried to use the U.S. for his goals. For the goals of the Israeli state. And this is what we're seeing play out in really, devastating ways right now.
But I think,
not just the world economy.
We're almost out of time. I think that's going to be one of the reckonings of this conflict, gentlemen, is a reassessment of the U.S.-Israeli relation. Because that's coming up, you know, front and center. Too many people found out because of the Gaza genocide.
The American public has to push for this reckoning. That was my point.
Well, we're doing our bit right here, gentlemen. Okay, that's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Calgary, Toronto, and in London. Of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk Rules.